Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. And we got a great guest on today. We'll introduce him here in just a second, but I wanted to say hello to my co-host, Mr. Rob Greenlee. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good morning, Todd. It's another fine day in the world of new media.
Yes, it is. It's a very early day here in Honolulu. Actually, I had a very short night last night. I was telling you before we started the show here, it was about 1:30 in the morning, go to bedtime. I don't know why, but I'm flying out tonight. So it's just like trying to get a whole bunch of stuff done the night before. But you know, that's just par for the course. But I want to welcome our guest as well, Mr. Dan Rayburn from streamingmedia.com. When Rob told me that you were doing home renovations, I said, didn't he just get done with a show? Because usually after a show, I want to like vegetate for a week. Good morning.
I did, unfortunately, trying to do a few too many projects at once. But yeah, we just finished the show last week. We had the Streamy E-Show and we had the Content Delivery Summit, which are great. So there's certainly a lot going on in the world of online video and a lot we can discuss today.
Yeah, I'm excited to get the full rundown. But you and Rob go a long, long ways back. Rob was telling me a little history. Rob, you want to say something on that? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting journey, the whole streaming media thing. I was involved in kind of doing some streaming media things back in the late 90s and the early 2000s, back during the earlier heyday of streaming. And then it kind of went for a little dip, and I'm sure Dan can kind of expand on that. And then it has come charging back. So I figured it was a really good time to bring him on and give some perspective of where we are around streaming. And I think it's basically starting to take over the world now. Wouldn't you agree, Dan?
It is pretty amazing just how many devices now are capable of getting video. If you think about it, you can't go anywhere. Phone, game console, tablet, TV, smart TVs, obviously computers. Now we're starting to see some interesting things potentially come out, maybe even with watches. It's incredible how online video went from a really small industry and a small business, or in some cases, no business back in the late 90s, early 2000s, to where you have segments of this market doing billions of dollars a year in revenue. So it really turned into a business. Many of us, who were early to the market didn't know it was going to be a real business. We were doing it because it was fun and it was exciting. But it's incredible to watch it over the last 16 or 17 years grow into just another tool that businesses and consumers use to consume content on any device imaginable, just about.
A few years ago when the Roku came on the market, and I told my team immediately, I said, man, we need to be on that box. That thing's going to go gangbusters. And I think we were at number 26, 27, and 28 or something like that. We were real early down the Roku and putting our network's content up. And it really was this landswell of new people that were coming in and watching the content a different way. But I think what's really interesting to me is having gone to CES a number of years, everything now is tied to some sort of streaming device. If they have it seems like if it has a screen on it, they've got they've got Netflix, they've got all the standard stuff that's available for consumers to be able to stream video, television, not necessarily linear stuff, but non-linear stuff. Is, man, it's hot, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what content owners are trying to do. They're trying to get their content on every platform and every device imaginable. The interesting thing when you mentioned the Roku is, as cool and as exciting as all these devices are, Roku's only sold 5 million boxes in 5 years. That's not a wide deployment. Apple has sold 14 million Apple TVs, Generation 2 and Generation 3, in the last just about 3 years. So other than the Xbox 360 and the PS3, and I don't really count the original Nintendo Wii, there's not a lot of boxes out in the market. You would think there'd be more, but there really aren't. And this market, as far as streaming devices goes, it's really just starting. Now, some people will say, well, that's because everything's going via smart TV. Vizio just announced that they'll have, or they now have, 3.2 million smart TVs in the market that they've sold, but that's over the last 3 years. And that's not how many are connected, that's just how many they've sold. So for all the talk by the media of devices and streaming content, the adoption is still actually pretty small today. And it's only going to really start to grow in the next couple of years.
Do you think that, Rob, I'll let you direct this conversation too, but the question then is, you know, the worry I have is people are going to go to, you know, their big box, or they're going to go to, hang on a second. They're going to go to their big box, or, and they're going to look at the price delta, and they're going to say, well, I'll just buy a regular set. But I think the price differential's slowly closing, isn't it? And, but the question is, what are people actually hooking these TVs up that they're buying, or do they have an actual accurate number on how many are actually connecting the connected TVs? Do we know that number?
They do. They just won't share them with us. But yeah, they know. They can tell how many TVs have been connected to, whether it's, you know, Samsung's hub or Vizio's. The real question is, how many people are you reaching? Because, for instance, I have 4 or 5 Rokus at home.
Right.
But I'm only one consumer. Now, I'm not the typical consumer. I have a lot of devices. I do it for work. I test it. But think about how many consumers have a Roku and an Apple TV.
Yeah.
Quite a few. So it's still not reaching as large an audience as some make it out to be. It is when it comes to the PC, because Netflix and Hulu and all those services, a lot of it, the majority of it, is still being viewed on the PC. Over time, that'll shift as more devices come out. Tablets are certainly helping that quite a bit. You know, Apple's iPad is helping a lot in terms of how content is now consumed on a different device, different screen. But we still have a long way to go as an industry, because most of these box manufacturers too, they're not making money. Roku announced just this past week that they raised another $60 million. So you have a lot of boxes that have come to the market that have disappeared in the last year or two. You got the Sony SMP N100, you got the Logitech Review, Sony SMP 200, the second model they did, they took off the market. You have the Boxy Box by D-Link, gone. So the device manufacturers, outside of guys like Apple and Sony and Samsung, they're having a really hard time trying to figure out a profitable business model, because today they're just not making money selling a $100 box.
Last month, or actually not last month, the very first of this month, we put out a press release. we're still doing that. Basically, we had a sampling. We did for at least the podcast media, we looked at how the media was being consumed, and this probably will come as no surprise to you, but you know, it kind of broke down this way. Desktop, and this was a 69.7 million sampling, audience sampling, across a 3-month period. But desktop applications such as iTunes, 36.7%, smartphones and mobile devices such as the iPhone and Android, 30.3%. Web browsers, 18.3%. Tablets, such as the iPad and Nexus, 8.8%. Mobile applications, 3.2%. Smart TV, OTT, set-top boxes, 2.7% of that total 69.7 million audience. So, at least our numbers kind of back up what you're saying as well.
Yeah, it's going to take time to see that shift. Everyone thinks it happens overnight, but it really takes a long time. It takes many, many years of consumers finding new content, realizing that the services are getting simpler and easier to use. It takes guys like Netflix and Hulu and MLB and others making the UI much simpler and easier to use, which they've done. They've done a very good job of that over the years. But it's interesting how the media talks about a lot of the streaming services in the market as if it's going to replace broadcast TV, which is a real shame, because it's not replacing broadcast TV. And the industry, historically, the media's covering our industry has always been adamant that one thing replaces another. And typically that never happens. It's a complement to it. The internet didn't replace cable TV. TV didn't replace the radio. So streaming services is just another way to consume content. It's not a replacement for broadcast. It's something that you're going to use based on the type of content you want to see, what device do you want to play it back on, what is the quality you want, and also which device or platform actually has the content, because not every device and platform has all the content you're looking for. So as a consumer, it's about using the best combination of devices and platforms based on what you want to watch. But it's definitely not replacing broadcast television. That's simply not happening. Someone said the other day that, and you hear about this a lot, people say internet TV is replacing or taking over broadcast. And it's actually the exact opposite. Broadcast TV is taking over the internet, because just about everything you watch on the internet is produced for broadcast first. And that's a shift that we're going to continue to see, professionally produced content on the web.
Well, yeah, and I think, Dan, that's exactly what you said. The last word that came out of your mouth is that it's all about content. It's all about what's driving the usage of these portable, you know, these smaller set-top box devices is an alternative access and user experience to get to the same content that they're trying to get on broadcast TV. So really the broadcast TV folks and the TV networks just need to do a much better job of making the great content that they produce available on these newer set-top boxes. But the problem is that it breaks their business models, and that's why we're seeing this this kind of slow growth of these alternative ways of getting this content.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd say it's breaking their business model. It's upsetting their business model, but that's only because they don't understand the market that they're going into. Now they're starting to realize it. The other thing is the studios are all about windowing. You know, think of how a movie works. It comes out at the theater, and then it'll come out as pay-per-view, or then it'll be VOD, and then it'll be rental, and then you'll be able to buy the physical asset. The broadcasters are all about windowing. TV shows are the same with syndication.
Well, and that's
the thing that's confusing the media right now is you have guys like Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, and now also Yahoo, who are going to be creating some original content, or in Netflix's case, already has. And that's nice, but it's a shame because people now who don't track the market think that the industry is moving to original content for the web. And when Netflix creates something like House of Cards and spends $100 million to do so, how many shows can somebody like Netflix really produce when they're spending $100 million? Very little. So we're hearing a lot about original content today, but in the overall scope of things, if you think about all the inventory of content that Netflix or Hulu has, original content will never even make up 1% of that. So it's interesting. It's neat. I think they're, especially with guys like Amazon, they're doing a good job of being focused or targeting kids, very specific content. But original content specifically for the web is not the future, because content creation costs, that's the biggest amount of money that anybody is spending. It's not the distribution. It's not shipping bits from point A to point B. It's not the encoding or storage. It's the actual filming and creation of the production.
Well, and Dan, that whole windowing thing that you're talking about is about their business models, because that is what – there's these different stages of revenue that comes in from broadcast content. There's, you know, there's the on-air stuff. There's the syndication. There's the licensing for, you know, different platforms. And there's all these different revenue streams that come in that to – you know, it's really kind of a double-dip scenario for content out there, which is not something that exists on the web or the internet side of the fence. And if they put all their content on the web, that bypasses all these other revenue opportunities that they have for that same content, that can thus keep their production costs at the level that will enable them to produce the kind of quality. It's kind of the, it's really key to them to keep that revenue stream up so they can afford to keep producing the content that attracts the big audiences. So it's really kind of a tug of war that there's really no alternative answer for at this point. And I agree with you. I'm not really sure, and I think they're still struggling with the idea of, well, how can they replace those revenue streams based on an online-only distribution strategy? And I don't think anybody has an answer to that yet.
Yeah, I think they could, though. I think, keep in mind, we all know the studios, TV and broadcasters, movie guys, they're slow to adopt. I mean, look at the music industry. They were so slow to adopt digital.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't like Netflix when it first came out. Now, all of a sudden, they're happy to take the big checks that Netflix is cutting, you know, a couple $1 billion every year in licensing costs. So they're starting to make money off digital. There's no question. You know, the thing I find interesting is, what happens if somebody like a Netflix or Amazon, who's creating original content, then takes that content and licenses it to the broadcasters for syndication?
Yeah, I've been thinking
now
about that.
They flip things around, which would be interesting. Again, not hugely relevant in terms of revenue because they don't create that much original content. But I think broadcasters and content owners are finally starting to realize that consumers are going to use multiple services. People are not cutting the cord in volume and going online to get video. The quality of video online is nowhere near what you get to TV. Now, sometimes it doesn't matter. If you're watching on your iPad, it's a smaller screen. You don't need to get broadcast HD quality. But on the internet, there's no standard for what HD is. The industry as a whole is not defined what classifies HD on the web. So you have to figure out as a consumer, and that's the unfortunate part, the fragmentation of the market, what content is available on what device, at what quality, and in what business model. Is it part of a subscription? Is it pay-per-view? Is it pay-to-own? Am I downloading it and owning it? Or am I buying a physical DVD or Blu-ray like Amazon sells? So it is very confusing because when you walk into a Costco or a Best Buy, none of these stores have their smart TVs connected to the internet.
Right.
Or the streaming boxes. So as a consumer, you're still buying TVs based on screen size.
Yeah.
Not based on the smart TV platforms. So the industry as a whole, the CE manufacturers still have a long way to go in terms of making it clear when somebody's buying or purchasing a device, what's actually available on it and what the quality is. But you know, one thing that this industry has to get past, and it's going to, I don't know if they ever will, unfortunately, due to the media, is the idea that internet TV can replace broadcast TV distribution. It can't do it from a physical standpoint. The internet was not set up to support video in large volumes. It never will be. People will argue me all day long and say, oh, well, every year there's better compression and the servers push out more stream. It doesn't matter. The way streaming media technology works, there's an inherent latency in it. There is a single point of failure, multiple single point of failure, yeah. The server, the encoder. You don't have that in broadcast. When you turn on your TV, it works. Now, there's a lot of people complaining they don't like their TV bill and what they're paying, but they're not paying it. They're still paying.
Right.
There are over 106 million paying subscribers in the U.S. today. So there is a lot of hype by the media over a lot of the topics we're talking about. And unfortunately, that tends to set expectations incorrectly as well.
You know.
So, Dan, one thing, too, I think if you look at the Xbox One and what's been talked about there, it almost looks like what the future may look like, and that's what's really behind the set-top boxes, is a new user experience for broadcast TV. So is that, do you think, ultimately where this is going to wind up is that there's going to be a lot of content that's going to be consumed on tablets and phones and things like that, but better experiences need to be applied to broadcast TV and the on-demand world of broadcast TV from a software and experiences. And once we do that, then there's going to be less of this tug-of-war that's going on between, you know, whether content's all on the web or it's still on broadcast.
I don't know. As a consumer, you know, the Xbox One, it sounds interesting. You got HDMI pass-through. You can do overlays. Some boxes in the market already have that, like the Vizio CoStar and some others.
Yeah.
But we don't know what the Xbox One will be priced probably until E3. And if it comes out at $400 or $500, the average consumer isn't going to buy that. And then if you have somebody like my mom who wants to just get some Netflix content, buying a $70 Roku, you know, that's not somebody who's ever going to buy an Xbox. But I think too many people are so concerned with trying to fix broadcast TV. You know, they always say things like, well, you know, broadcast TV is broken. It's a legacy business. You know, its future is dead.
A multi-billion dollar legacy base.
Right. Tens of billions of dollars.
I mean, right.
Take it to online video advertising. People say, all the ad dollars are shifting from TV to the internet. This year, depending on whose report you look at, the online video advertising market is under $1 billion.
I believe that.
The broadcast TV market for advertising, the last time I looked, was something like $40 billion. So that's not a lot of money shifting. It will over time. We'll see more of that, and it takes a long time. But as a consumer, when I turn on my TV, it works. I know what kind of quality I'm going to get. I know what HD is. The channels change fast. The program guide, whether I use Verizon's or I use TiVo's, works well. I can easily find content that I want to see. I can easily record it. I personally don't think broadcast TV is broken or dead in any way, shape, or form. It works really well.
So is the opportunity or the challenge for them more of a generational thing, where there's a lot of younger people that are not clued into the traditional consumption on broadcast TV, and they're only consuming through Netflix, or they're only streaming online, or they're really hooked on YouTube. So, yeah. I mean, are we really looking at a generational issue here? And that's the real threat.
Well, that's a valid question to ask. It's unknown at this point, but unfortunately, too many people are looking at that and saying, okay, well, all right, I'm 38. I'm not the young generation. So, the younger folks who are growing up now, they're not going to have cable TV. They're never going to get it. Well, I know many guys who've gotten out of, college at 21, 22 years old who never had cable on their own, but they're getting it now because they want sports.
Right.
And as we all know, if you want sports, you got to go to TV for that, unless you want to deal with blackout restrictions. So no. I don't think that's a guarantee. There's a lot of people saying, the younger generation will never get TV. I don't think that's true. I also know people who didn't have it, who were using online primarily. But the moment they had kids, they got TV because they wanted to make it easy for their kids to watch cartoons all day. So the media uses that idea that, people who have cable TV now are the older generation and none of the newer generation will want it. That's not accurate. It was the same argument that they used 6 or 7 years ago. And in that time frame, the number of cable subscribers is still going up. Now, it's not going up at the rate it used to, but there's also other factors at play there. When you see the data about cord cutting, you see a lot of people saying, that's going to be a trend. So far, it hasn't been a trend. In any given quarter, if you take all of the number of losses that all of the cable and satellite companies have had at any one time, in any one quarter, it didn't even equal 1% of the total number of subscribers to TV. The other issue is the moment somebody loses a subscriber, everybody assumes in the media that that's because that person is now getting content online. I know plenty of people who have cut the cord simply because in these economic times, they want to save as much money as they can.
Yeah.
I know a couple who cut the cord because they turned really old and went into an old folks home. I know plenty of people who are cutting the cord who are technically cord cutters, but the media immediately classifies them as these are people who have cut the cord simply to go online and use that as an alternative. And then you have to think about all the home foreclosures. One of the times we did see the largest number of cord cutters in the industry a little while ago, maybe about 2 years ago, it was also the same quarter we saw the most home foreclosures. So there's a lot of factors involved here. The media tries to make it real simple and just say, TV's dead, broadcast is ancient, and everyone's cutting the cord. But you'll notice most of those media articles, too, never mention numbers. They never tell you how many are cutting the cord. They never tell you that guys like Comcast and others are still making billions of dollars every quarter in profit. So it's not as if their business is having problems.
2 years ago, we cut the cord here for a year. And really, I was all on board up until when I got back from Vegas following, I think, CES 2012, and the cable was back on. And I was like, why is the cable back on? And my wife is like, well, I'm... every New Year's, they have this series of my wife's Japanese, these Japanese shows that are all around the New Year. And she says, I missed them. I couldn't watch them. So I called and had the cable turned back on. And so the cable's still on here, but we're, you know, what we found during that year was, you know, I was frustrated because, and it's gotten better with Hulu, but who knows what's going to happen with Hulu here and when they get sold. But, you know, this certain amount of content that I could get access to, but there was about, you know, a handful of things that I couldn't, that just never was available. Now, I'm not a sports guy, so I don't really miss the sports package. You know, as a matter of fact, I wish I didn't have to pay for that. But, you know, there was those four or five things that drove me crazy that I wanted to see. And I think ultimately, if ever some of those items align a little better, I might be back to the point of being able to cut the cord. But, you know, still, if I looked at what I was paying, I was paying $10 to Hulu, paying for the Roku, paying for Amazon. You know, I had to pay for like five or six services just to get replace, and I went, what's that, $50-$60, and I still was missing content. So yeah, right back up to $100.
Yeah, bill. You're a great example. There are people out there who could cut the cord because they're just not into a lot of the programming that's online. The average cable bill is over $100 today, but that also includes DVRs and all kinds of other fees and taxes. I pay about $100 a month for Verizon Triple Play. Out of that, cable's about $45 to $50. If I got Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu, you know, you're looking at $25 a month.
Yeah.
If I get MLB, I don't get local games, so all my Mets games are blacked out. If I buy one show a week from, you know, iTunes at $2 or $3, it adds up very quickly. And the other thing that the media forgets is things work well for consumers that are easy. TV is easy. So how many consumers are going to know where to go to what service to get what type of content and play it back on what type of device and what type of quality? It's not easy to do. If you're somebody who has a very specific interest, you know, let's say you're into Japanese animation. On the Xbox 360, there's a service, Crunchyroll, which is great. It's very specific, very targeted. It's going after just that audience. So you can go out there and sign up for very niche services. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's great that it's available, but that's not typical of the general population.
I think we can agree that, you know, broadcast is going to be around for a long time, you know, going to NAB. When Chiron software still cost $250,000, and, you know, everything, you know, that industry is not moving anywhere anytime soon. So what I'd like to do is shift gears a little bit and just talk a little bit about this space that, you know, that I kind of consider Rob and I in, and, you know, what's happening there. You know, just as a point of reference, when I started doing my show, it was audio only, and at about episode 600 and some, I added the video component, why people want to watch me sitting in this office, you know, for an hour and 15 minutes is a little bit beyond me, but and initially, they didn't watch. They really, really didn't. They were coming in and subscribing to the video in small numbers. But so what I decided to do is, okay, they're not watching when I'm recording, or actually when I'm putting up, making available on demand. So let's see if they'll watch when I stream. And what I kind of found then was that the numbers did climb, and it was because that there was just this, you know, this push up, and the tie into the Roku and everything made it a little easier. But, you know, even today I'm in Hawaii. So what does that mean? If I do my show at 8 p.m., 2 a.m. on the East Coast is not a time that you want to watch some tech dude talking about the latest tech news. So even that has its limitations. But if you look at like what Twit and what Revision 3 and what those guys have been able to accomplish, they've done very, very well in their genres, but they're still making most of their money from the contents being delivered really kind of on demand or as a subscription via iTunes or however they're going to get it. But
yeah, you know, mostly audio is where they're making their money.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you think the space is headed for guys like me or folks that have have the potential to put together? I think it really, it doesn't boil down to, in the end, the content.
It does. Whether it's audio or video, it's all about the content. You know, the whole audio side of the business, I stopped tracking radio and music streaming stuff back when CARP really hit, because it put so many stations off the air. and you had a lot of problems with radio stations trying to make any money. I think you still do today. Clear Channel and others, I don't think, are a great example because they have a main radio distribution business. They're not internet only that they piggyback off of. So things like radio, podcasts, music-related things, that has a very large audience. That's the good thing. The downside to that is it's very hard to do targeting, and the CPM rates aren't very high. So I'm noticing a lot of audio shows will do sponsorships, and some video shows do them as well. Guys like Revision 3, now owned by Discovery, do a lot of sponsors for their video instead of actual ads. So sponsorships are a good way, but it seems sponsors really want targeted demographic information, which a lot of these systems today still can't handle. You know, we still have a huge problem with delivering online video advertising. It's not targeted. Even though the vendors say they're targeting stuff, they're really not as of yet. You have the issues with live broadcast of inserting an ad into a live stream. How do you detect the tones? How do you insert it? Which platform are you using to do that? How do you sync it properly? Very difficult. So part of the advertising issues is a technology one, which I think is interesting because almost every other thing where people talk about there being a lack of technology or there's a technology hurdle, that's not the case. The technology has been around for so long. It's not a technology hurdle. It's a problem of content owners have to understand just because you can put your content on the internet doesn't mean it's worth anything. Doesn't mean it's worth money. What? YouTube's a great example of that.
Yeah, one thing that
based on Google's own stats, of all the video views that happen every day, Google only monetizes 20% of them. So I look at audio and video pretty much as the same thing. They're facing the same problems.
Having the experience of the day job working with 15,000 content creators and trying to sell advertising into that content, similar to what Revision 3 and Twit and the rest of the folks do, you know, the CPM dollars are the payment amounts are as much as maybe from what I normally see, maybe four times higher than what you would see out of maybe YouTube. You know, typically advertisers are paying $25 to $30 CPM for podcasts right now. But the challenge is, it's not that the CPM rates are great. The challenge is there's just not enough advertisers. We leave a lot of inventory on the table every month just because we can't sell it all. So same type of deal. We've got more inventory to sell than we have advertisers, and that's typically a bad thing. But what are you hearing from a rumor standpoint? Are you seeing increasing dollars being spent by the advertisers? Do those folks when they come to streaming media east or west, are they talking about that, or are they keeping that internal?
Well, they are, but the problem is they're talking about it every year. Every year they're saying they're looking for online video advertising opportunities, but they're looking to reach a very specific audience. CPMs aren't going up. If anything, it seems to have been going down a little bit. And that's the problem you have even for a large site. You know, if you're CNN and you're serving ads,
right,
the advertiser is not going to pay you much because they don't know who you're reaching.
Yeah.
And you're reaching such a broad spectrum of people. And that's why guys like Revision 3, Mashima, a bunch of folks who are creating content for a specific niche, like gaming, even some of the Wall Street stuff, financial information, healthology, things of that nature. Those guys see higher CPMs simply because it's more targeted.
Right.
So, streaming media is a good example. We get a CPM that's three times the normal rate in the industry. The only reason we get that is because the advertisers know exactly who we're reaching. We've been around 15 years. We're not reaching Joe Schmo off the street. We have very specific information of who our viewers and attendees are. So people are willing to pay more for that. But it's hard for a lot of companies. It was interesting when Hulu came along and said to advertisers, instead of forcing a specific video on a user, we're going to allow them to pick from two or three different movie trailers. And that was very smart because what Hulu told everybody was they were getting a higher CPM from the advertiser because the advertiser figured, and rightfully so, if you're letting that viewer pick which movie trailer they want to see, they're going to pick something that they're more interested in, more targeted in. So as a result, they paid a higher CPM for that. So we've seen some creative things done over the last few years, but it's still not mainstream yet.
Go ahead,
seems like, yeah, it seems like the opportunity for targeting is certainly a lot better on the online side than it is on broadcast TV. So I wonder over time that CPMs, as that targeting gets better, is going to go up just because of that contrast. So what do you think about that?
Well, it's hard to know because targeting online is difficult to do. I'm always amazed that when I go to some of these major, you know, sites, NBC News, you know, they're delivering commercials to me that, you know, have nothing to do with anything related to male. You know, I keep getting Gillette Venus Women's Razor commercials.
Right.
So they don't know that I'm male or female. Or I'll get an ad for a local business, except they don't know my zip code, so they're advertising Krispy Kreme, which is nowhere near me. And then many times they're also delivering me the same ad 5 or 6 times in a row. And that's just a lack of inventory available. But that's not great as far as a branding experience goes, because now all of a sudden you're getting tired of whatever that brand is and you have to watch it so many times over and over and over. So we've seen a lot of different creative things in stream, in page, ad overlays, pre-roll, post-roll. We're seeing content owners try all these different ad formats. Some of them aren't even videos. It's just a branding of the logo. You know, we're seeing that in some places where they show just the logo. We're seeing things where they ask you to watch something and then say, well, what was the brand that you took from this at the end? So they're trying to get as creative as they can, trying to figure out a way to do this. But we have limitations in the market. And the other thing is, reporting on this is huge metrics, because most of the pre-roll ads that come before a video, even though they're technically playing back when I go to watch the video content I want, I'm not watching the ads. If I see that ad's 30 seconds, I go and check email. I go do something else, and I'm not actually seeing that ad yet. That content owner is telling the advertiser that I saw it.
You know, one of the things that we were trying to address this from a new media standpoint, because of the way traditionally most of the content is being subscribed to, they're subscribing to an RSS feed, and whatever device they're watching it on, it typically is, you know, coming up in some sort of a menu system. So we developed this thing we called MetaMarks, where it allowed the content producer to say, here's the best place to put an ad. Here's the best place to put a pop-up. Here's the best place to, you know, drop in a survey thing. And we put that all together. But, you know, the adoption is the tough part. You can't get anybody to agree on anything from a, you know, because everyone wants to have their own, you know, everyone wants their own sandbox. No one can agree. And I just don't understand why in the streaming space or in the downloadable media space, why these folks haven't got on board. You know, and when I was out at NAB, you know, we were doing some stuff for the folks at Livestream, and I told Max, I said, why don't you have a way where we can ping you when to put an ad and so forth. And it's just not there. And I don't understand why it's so far behind.
It's simple. It's just greed. It's just money. Because the folks who control this space, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Samsung, Sony, you know, think of the, say, 10 companies that control the industry. They're never going to work together. It's never going to happen. Some people are under the delusion in our space, in the streaming media industry, that, you know, someday we'll have standards. We'll never have standards. This technology has been around 16 or 17 years. We have no standard bit rate, format, codec, aspect ratio, player, protocol, nothing. You know, Adobe and Microsoft come out with completely proprietary things. Then Apple does, then Google does, then Microsoft does, then Sony does. Everybody wants their underlying technology to be the standard because they want to get paid for it. And that's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen in the near term or long term.
At the detriment to the space.
We do have a few things like H.264 kind of became the standard codec. But now all of a sudden we're talking about HEVC and H.265. And you've got Google, who's come along with the whole WebMM stuff, which they acquired from Onto, from VP9. So even that codec stuff is starting to get questioned. it's not going to happen. It's unfortunate because it stops this industry from growing a lot faster.
Yeah.
And from a consumer standpoint, it frustrates all of us because it's not easy to use these services. And for someone like me, it's frustrating because I can't tell you how many questions I get every day from somebody who says, I bought a Roku, but I can't stream my iTunes to it.
Yeah.
Well, of course you can't. But consumers don't know that. They just expect the stuff to work, and that's just not the reality.
You know, it's interesting, too, because that they haven't figured out how to do that, because the broadcast people wouldn't survive without standards that says, okay, you know, here's my doop. You know, this is when the local ad runs. Doop, this is when we come back to live. And I don't understand. They've, you know, their whole livelihood depends on that. Is it because we don't have a central broadcast authority? It's guys like me. They're using, you know, little boxes like this from Livestream or a TriCaster, or is it that they, you know, they've all invested different? It just seems like the customer would demand it. You know, the customer of this equipment, the customer of, you know, that's producing the stuff would demand it. I don't understand why. It just baffles me. And, you know,
it's a very valid point. I mean, no one can argue with what you're saying. The problem is that in the broadcast world, the broadcast ecosystem was always set on standards like satellite and cable head ends. What HD, 720, 1080, it was always set on standards. The way streaming video first started was you had Real Networks, you had Zing Streamworks, you had VideoNet, then you had Microsoft who jumped in and bought Video. So then you had Microsoft and you had Real competing, and they had two technologies out there. You had to pick one or the other, but of course each was proprietary.
Right.
And over the years, those businesses from both of those companies have changed. But the thing with the online video world is there's such a huge video ecosystem of how do you create, ingest, store, transcode, manage, protect, syndicate, monetize, deliver, and track that video.
Yep.
It's an entire ecosystem that includes a lot of pieces from a lot of different companies. In the broadcast world, you don't really have that. You have that video ecosystem, but from day one, the technology used on the back end has been the same. You're delivering this stuff through a private network. It's coming off of a satellite. Anytime you put something up to a bird or pull it down, it's reliable unless the bird falls out of the sky. The internet's not reliable. People right. built these businesses off of a completely unreliable distribution system. And that's been the big problem is as a result of the unreliability, you're constantly having to deal with multiple companies coming into the space using different technology, different protocols, different servers, different licensing. And for a content owner, it's a nightmare. A lot of people don't realize, we heard at the show last week, we heard guys at Viacom and others say, the biggest problem we have is not delivering content from point A to point B. That's commoditized. Using a CDN, that's simple. Yep. It's efficient. It's cheap. They say the biggest problem they have is they have to take one piece of content and transcode it 20 different times to get it to every platform or device, use three or four different types of content protection technologies. Then they have to track all this stuff. They have to deliver ads and syndication, but they have to have rules about where it can and can't go. And then multiply that times another issue. They have 60 websites, and then you have to have a player. And keep in mind, the player by itself, you know, the player that you have on an Xbox, that player won't work on an iPad. So then you have to build a custom player for every single app. So it's just a nightmare when there's no standards. And the broadcast world, they got that right from day one.
Yeah, they sure did. And it's, you know, and we last week we had a guy on from the FCC talking about the closed captioning requirements. And, you know, so now, you know, if they've done it on broadcast, when they put it up online, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be closed captioned. So they've had to go back and re-engineer everything to make sure that they're compliant there. So I don't know what's going to drive it, if anything. So, you know, the broadcast people, if nothing else, will probably demand some standards at some point, or they're just going to implement their own, and everyone's going to have to follow. But from my perspective, it's, you know, this to us, this has been, Rob, you know, you guys were doing, you know, when you were doing your radio program, you had a set format. I think for us, the beauty of this is I can go as long or short as I want. I'm not constrained. And from a new media side, from a guy that's just, you know, creating content out of a studio, it's, I love the space right now. I really do. And the ability to get the content in all glass, it's an equalizer. But still it's, the industry is nowhere, at least in my opinion, is we've got a long, long way to go. And I wish things would move a lot faster, but it seems just goes as a snail's pace. It drives me nuts.
Dan, to follow up your comments about, you know, what's happening around how kind of distributed all this encoding and players and all this stuff and how proprietary it is, I know my personal experience working on Zune, I mean, I saw it firsthand how each of these platforms takes a master piece of content from a major, you know, TV network or studio, and they have to create their own media file so that they have their own proprietary specs on how they encode it, and just like what you're saying about these proprietary players, but it's also it adds a lot of costs to the distribution of the online content side, where each of these platforms, Sony, Microsoft, you know, the Amazon folks and Netflix, they're all doing separate encodes, multiple encodes to their own proprietary thing, and it just adds so much cost. I know that was the big issue that I saw firsthand, was just the multi-millions of dollars that are spent on encoding and storing these files in all these different platforms, where if you had some standard, and I know back in the early, you know, a few years back, there was an effort in Hollywood to create this kind of this central archive of all, you know, TV shows and movies and things like that would be encoded once and shared to all the platforms. But it never got off the ground because each of the players didn't want to cooperate in really kind of rolling that out. So do you think we're going to get to a point where there can be one standard encode? And do the studios need to take control of that back? I mean, if you look at what podcasts are doing today, the content provider is doing all of the encoding for all of their distribution. Do you ever see a time when the studios actually take control of the encoding of all of the files that are then distributed at Netflix and at Microsoft and at Apple and all these places?
No, definitely not, because the studios don't have control. The platform and the device manufacturers that they're distributing across are the ones who have control.
Yeah.
So when Apple comes out with the iPad and says, okay, Flash is no longer going to work on it, and if you want to get your content to the iPad, you have to do the following, what is a content owner going to do? They don't have control because they don't own the device. So content owners have really no means and no ability to set the rules or the standards, because without the device to see manufacturers and the platform providers, the streaming services, they would have no way to make money. So when Xbox says you have to produce your content in this file format and this is this, you know, codec we need it in, what are they going to say? No.
Right.
So that's the problem. We are never going to have a standard, ever. I know some people want to just debate that all day long with me, but it's been 17 years. We don't have a standard yet. People were talking about standards over the past 17 years. We're no closer today. We're definitely not going to have one.
You know, and it doesn't stop there. It's, you know, you look at every device has its own proprietary code. When we, you know, figuring out the Roku and building the channel for that, you know, we were very early and their documentation was very sparse. It's a lot better today, obviously. But, you know, that was a major undertaking. I think we probably spent $25,000 in developer costs to get that done. The easiest platform, which is really kind of dead at this point to develop for, was Boxy. Building a channel on Boxy was a piece of cake. I don't think we spent more than $2,000 or $3,000 to do that. But then on the flip side, when we went and talked to Samsung about going into their smart TV and having the channel in there, it was all new code, again, all proprietary. But the thing there was, man alive, they ate me to death and just lawyer costs and doing the, you know, the licensing to get into it. And I a couple of years ago, I asked a, and it's, you know, that, so that barrier to entry is tough to, and I'm just a small little company. I can't imagine what Netflix, what hair they must pull out trying to keep their player, keep their app playing in all those different devices. It's got to be a tremendous outlay in cash each quarter just to keep it up.
It's interesting you mention that. At the show last week, we had somebody from Netflix walk through the technical history of their player since their streaming service started. Very interesting. You can actually go to streamingmedia.com/east, and if you click on program, you can download their slides. The videos aren't up yet, but the slides are fascinating because, just like you're saying, it shows how they started off with a very simple player and how they've had to advance it over the years. They didn't talk about cost, but they did talk about, here are some of the workarounds that they did in order to make things work on other services that, you know, maybe that wasn't the way they were told to do it, but they made it work anyway. So it also showed just how creative they were. Right on the website you're on there, if you click on program up the top there in the navigation, you'll see then there's links to the slides. And it was on day one that we had an encoding engineer from Netflix do it. And your point is dead on. It's complex and it's costly. These companies are spending a lot of money doing this.
You know, that's one of the reasons why we kind of held back. We built for the Google TV. We built for Samsung. We built for Boxy. We built for a couple of obscure boxes that are no longer in existence. We built for the Roku. And I said, okay, let's look at the percentage. And, you know, I just read the percentage off to you earlier. At least on my part of our business, we said, okay, let's wait and let's see what happens. And we've got to be on these primary devices. And if Apple ever does something with the Apple TV, which I'm hoping that they will, and maybe you can give us some insight on what you think they're going to do there. If they do something, we'll obviously be in that device, or if they open it to the App Store or whatever they're going to do, we'll have to be there. But, you know, when I talk to my daughter, she don't care about any of that stuff. She just watches stuff on her laptop. So I think that's where stuff is really, you know, it's really where the content's being consumed right now. But, you know, do you think that, I lost my train of thought here. Do you think Apple's going to do something? And they keep talking about it or hinting about it.
Well, the media is talking about it. Apple's not talking about it. Apple simply says that they want to make the TV experience different. They haven't said how. Apple can't make the quality of the TV screen any better. They're not going to go to OLED or 4K because those TVs are way too expensive. So can Apple actually do anything to the hardware of a TV set to make it perform better? No, they can make it look nicer. They could design something that's high tech, but they can't actually make the screen. They can't make the quality of the video any better. So what does that leave them? It leaves them with two things: either the UI, user experience on that TV set. So how do you find content? How do you navigate that content? How do you watch that content? And the second thing is they could come out with some sort of subscription service like a Netflix has for a monthly fee. The problem that Apple has is they have no control in the living room because they refuse to license iTunes platform to any TV manufacturer.
Right.
So the only way they can get into the living room, the only way to get content to a TV is to buy an Apple $99 device. And while they've sold 14 million of them, at $99, a lot of people, when they're buying a whole setup, you know, Apple's saying, oh, you should buy this too because you can do AirPlay. And people are buying it for that reason. So. Right. And they're not buying them in huge droves. And I am so sick and tired of hearing the media write about an all-in-one Apple TV unit. You've got guys on Wall Street who are predicting it for year after year after year. I wrote a blog post recently saying the media should be ignoring these guys. I'm so tired of going to the Bloomberg and they're interviewing the guys talking about an Apple TV all-in-one unit who 5 years ago predicted and guaranteed it'll be out, you know, in 1 year. 5 years later, the same guy is still saying, oh, the Apple TV is coming next year. Who cares? Even if they came out with a unit, there's not enough of them that are going to be sold to impact the market.
Yeah.
How many Apple TVs can be sold? Well, we know Apple stuff is not cheap, so it'll be more expensive than the average TV. If you look at the best analyst estimates who track the TV market, they say that Apple could sell, they think Apple could sell, if they had an all-in-one unit, which I don't think they'll ever have, they could sell 3 million sets in the first 2 years.
That's nothing.
How is 3 million sets impacting the market?
Yeah, it's not. It's not.
So Apple is just so irrelevant when it comes to the living room. And no matter what they do, they can't change that, because the fact is they don't control distribution last mile. That's the MSO. They don't control the set-top box or any of the hardware on it. That's the MSO with someone like a Motorola. And they don't make TVs. And even if they did, they'd buy the screens from the same two or three factories that everybody buys them from. So the hardware itself wouldn't be any different than what you can get today. So what additional value are they really adding?
Well, I mean, isn't it possible that they could do a similar type of play to what the Xbox One is trying to do, by trying to work with live broadcast TV through the Apple TV to create kind of a new set-top box?
But didn't Google sure. just do that to it?
Pardon me?
They absolutely could. I mean, they could create a new Apple TV that has HDMI in and out, pass through, so you can then overlay that on top of your TV. But then what value are they adding? Some sort of program guide?
Yeah.
Okay, it might be interesting, but the Apple TV has no DVR functionality.
Right.
So now I can't record shows through that interface. The Apple TV today doesn't even allow you to play back local content via a USB drive. So it's just such a limited box. And even AirPlay, you'd think they'd go out and license AirPlay to TV manufacturers so that they could get rid of the box in the middle. But they haven't done that either. And we heard rumors 2 years ago that that was going to be demoed at CES, AirPlay working on third-party TVs. And that never happened. So a lot of people in the media love to write about stuff that isn't true and isn't real because they write for headlines. I only care about what actually comes out of the market, what actually gets sold, what gets adopted. Because having been in the market 16, 17 years, I've heard how many times, 100 times or more, that this new technology is a game changer. This is where the industry is going to change. We've heard about multicasting. Remember multicasting in the 2000 time frame? That was going to revolutionize the industry. Never got adopted. So I only care about what actually gets adopted and what gets sold.
So,
whereas a lot of people only want to care about what gets hyped or what gets talked about.
Dan, sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you think we're going to leapfrog the DVR functionality over time to just go straight to on-demand? And that could be what Apple does here, is that they don't build in a DVR capability because they have all the content there on-demand. I don't know. So what do you think about that?
Well, you have a lot of issues on the legal side with DVR in the cloud. You know, think of the lawsuit that I believe it was Cablevision had with the TV manufacturers. But no, I don't see Apple all of a sudden saying you can now, well, you know, we'll now offer a service where you can do DVR in the cloud online, because it also just wouldn't be reliable. When the cable companies are doing DVR in the cloud, they're doing it again through the last mile. It's a private network that they control. Apple doesn't control any private network. They don't control the last mile to your home.
Yeah.
So you would then have to be consuming shows from Apple streaming from the cloud, which quality-wise wouldn't be anything close to what you get off of DVR, physical DVR, or in the cloud from a last-mile provider. Mm-hmm. I also don't think that's enough of a offering in the market to interest a large quantity of people. I mean, the DVRs that I have now, whether they're from TiVo or they're from Verizon, they're simple and they work. They don't cost a lot of money. So what is Apple going to provide me that's so much better that it's in the cloud? I know guys like Dish and others, you see these commercials like record five shows at once. Who's recording five shows at once?
Right.
I mean, I watch a lot of TV, but I can't imagine someone needing to do five shows at once.
I like at least two, maybe.
Right, two, three maybe at the most. So I don't think there's a problem with DVRs today. Again, I think the media is overhyping that, saying, oh, DVRs are outdated and they're old because it has a physical hard drive. So what? It works, and it works really well, and the experience is good.
So Dan, what's exciting you right now? What are you really like jazzed about? Maybe something come out of the show, something you've heard, a trend that you're kind of seeing. What are you really excited about from the streaming side?
Nothing. Nothing new. Oh, no, you know, that's a question I get asked by people all the time. What am I excited about? Here's the thing that people miss. Yeah, I have a different vision of this.
Dan's been
people
around too
always
long.
Always want to be excited about one particular thing, whereas I'm excited every year at the rate that everything in the industry is growing. As an industry, we're building a business. We're building a long-term, sustainable business in different segments of the market. So a lot of people think an Apple TV or a Roku. No single device or single technology changes this industry. What you need is you need an entire ecosystem like we spoke of before. So what really excites me is the fact that hosting video online is much cheaper. Hell, YouTube does it for free.
Yep.
Transcoding is becoming easier. Guys like encoding.com and others that do transcoding in the cloud. Very simple, very easy. We have some standards starting to come out with protocols, HTTP Live, HLS, the MPEG Dash Consortium. That's definitely helping. What I see is business continuing to grow. And that's what excites me, because far too many people in this industry either weren't around in the 98 to 2001 time period or want to forget that expectations in our industry were set poorly for 2 or 3 years. Money was given to everybody. And when the market crashed, all of these companies out there realized that they had no business model whatsoever, because they were focused on technology and they were not focused on how they could turn that technology into a business. So what excites me every year is we continue to grow as an industry. Consumers consume more content on more devices for longer periods of time at higher quality every year. And that's how you build a long-term sustainable business. So for me, I'm never excited about just one device or one technology or one company, because it takes so many different technologies and companies in the space to make anybody successful.
You know, one thing, I'm kind of down here in the weeds and I always go for the nice shiny stuff. You know, I go to the NAB, I go to different shows and see different things. And, you know, I was real excited with some of the stuff that the folks at Livestream announced with their new boxes. And of course, I, you know, this show, I do it on a TriCaster, and, you know, that's a not an inexpensive box. And I like to see folks like Telestream with Wirecast and, you know, the ability to really put a 2 or 3 camera system together for someone that wants to do a show at a reasonable price. And, you know, look at what, you know, the stuff that, you know, I think about how we're changing and how we're doing conventions and how we're covering stuff, because, you know, it's getting to the point where, you know, the bandwidth, at least being able to do live, is got to the point, even on the mobile networks, we're really close to be able to do a lot of stuff that we couldn't do before and not have to throw this huge, huge amount of cash at it. You know, you look at what Wiles is doing, and it just, all those players, I think, are really shaping things. Maybe I'm missing some names here, but, it's obviously that, it's getting easier for guys like me to do this. And, you know, but ultimately, you know, the content's got to be good or the audience won't come one way or the other. But it's cool that it's easy to do, and maybe it's a little bit too easy. But did you catch, I'm sure you caught this, but YouTube opened up their live platform to anyone that had more than 1,000 subscribers to their channel. Are they,
right.
Are they now, you know, I wonder what their play is on that.
Well, everything you said is true. This has become much easier. It's become much more cost-effective. TriCaster, some of these other products out there, they're awesome. You know, I think about when I used to do webcasting in 96, 97, 98, we didn't have any of these products.
Right.
Webcasting was truly an art back then. You had to bond ISDN lines together. We didn't have DSL. It was a real art. And there was only a handful of guys who could do it well. Today, like you say, webcasting is available to the masses. The problem is, how many of the people who are doing these live streaming webcasts are actually making money?
Right.
Very small percentage. So while the technology has opened it up to a lot of people, the business and the models have not come along so far for those people to actually make it a sustainable business. And that's the concern, is this industry has always been very good at talking about what can be done and the technology around it and hyping how easy it is and it's become cheap and you don't need a lot of money anymore. That's all true. But the bottom line is, you still have to have a physical business behind your content. People have to want to get your content. Like you said, content is it's all about the quality of the content. YouTube's model, I have no idea, you know, what that is, but the average subscriber, the average channel on YouTube, if they only have 1,000 subscribers, they're never going to make any money by doing
right,
live.
Right, right.
So it's just not relevant. It's only relevant for those who actually have an audience with compelling content that people are actually going to be willing to pay for, or advertisers will be willing to sponsor.
You know, this show, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, 90% of my income that keeps the lights on here and keep my family fed come from the audio portion of my show. And really the video portion, even with two advertisers or two or three advertisers are typically in my programming, the cost of delivery and the amount of money that I make on that advertising, it's pretty close to a wash on the video side. So, you know, unless advertising rates go up dramatically, which I doubt it will because there's so much content in the space, it's tough. It really is to make it. And, you know, make it to scalable to make enough money. And, you know, I hear it all the time from guys, are, you know, they want to do the show full time. And then we look at their audience and, man, unless you have a super niche, you know, like unless you're a neurosurgeon who is the world renowned expert and you have a thousand doctors that listen to you, you can't charge, you know, $10,000 for that episode. You know, you're not going to make money enough to barely pay for your hosting costs. So.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Yeah, I understand that completely. I don't know where it's just economy of scale is what it really is, isn't it?
Well, I think it comes back to content so much in scale. Most content is crap. <That's> content true. Owners hate when I say that, but just because you have a camera, now you know everyone thinks they're a videographer because their phone has a camera in it. That doesn't make you good at producing content.
That's right.
That doesn't mean you can write a script, you can light it right, you can shoot it right, you can do editing. You know, so much goes into producing quality content. I think, unfortunately, for producers, they're now not thought of, or in many cases in the online world, as something that is really valuable because everybody thinks now, oh, I can just spend $30,000, get the gear I need, and I can shoot what I want. True, but that doesn't mean it's going to be in good quality. So that's unfortunate because producing content that's quality, something that people actually want to watch and something you can monetize, it's not easy. That's a very difficult business to do. You need a lot of talent. You need to be very smart at who you're targeting, and only a very small percentage of total content owners can actually do that successfully.
You know, one of the people in the chat room basically, and I kind of summarize his comments. He basically says, TV's easy. I turn it on, it's there. I turn on my Xbox. I got to figure out which selection I'm in. I got to change the input. You know, I have to click, 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 and I have to, you know, go through five different menu systems. He says it basically it's not easy. And that's true because that's where TV owns HDMI 1 input, you know, and until that changes, they're not going anywhere.
But I also think that that's a generational issue, I think, as well. I think the younger generation is used to having to be in more control of their content, right? And in using software to get to that. And I think over time it is going to get easier to use software to get to content. But I don't see it as big a hurdle as maybe we're portraying it here. But I think there is a difference, right? I mean, clearly we can agree that there's a difference in that user experience, but I think that the younger generation and the next generation is going to be much more adaptable to that. And I think being in control of what you consume and what you watch and when you watch it is clearly the future. This going in and turning on a TV and sitting back and not having any control over that, I just don't see that as the future either.
Well, you know, it's an interesting space, and the technology is there. I just wish we'd get everyone to talk to one another for all the delivery.
Kumbaya.
Yeah, it's too bad too. And I got a good friend that works at Hayvision, and you know, he was kind of quizzing me recently. Says, you know, where's this thing going? You know, from my perspective, you know, he's up here I'm down here and I'm like, I'm telling him where I see things going. And, you know, believe it or not, I think the manufacturers, you know, companies like Haivision and they're all trying to figure out where this thing's going to go next to have products that are going to support it. But, you know, they're still their number one business is the broadcast industry. It's not the streaming industry there. You know, they have a huge, huge broadcast division. So
as do most of those companies,
right?
You think of Elemental Technologies, Haivision, Inlet, Cisco. These guys are making a lot of revenue off of traditional broadcasters who then want to do a multi-screen business or deliver content to multiple devices. But you're absolutely right. A large portion of their revenue for the most part is coming from still traditional broadcast models, not online.
And not to mention that the traditional broadcast people have lobbyists and they have their buddies that have grown up through the ranks, end up on the FCC or whatever group that makes decisions. And, you know, they are going to protect their interests tooth and nail. And all I can hope is that as time moves on and as, you know, my daughter, who is 22, she still, her connectivity is through her laptop and her tablet. She's not a cable subscriber. She has an internet service, and that's her lifeline to the world. But at the same point, you know, sometimes when I talk to her, she's a little bit disconnected because there's a lot of stuff you can get on broadcast TV that you cannot get via the net. But she so chooses to do that. But I think she's still a minority in that. I think you're right, Dan, that when people get out of college and have a little money and get some kids, mm-hmm. You know, they want to, I don't even know if this TV program's still on. They want to put the kids in front of Barney or from Sesame Street or whatever. And that's where they want their kids to be. So that drives a cable subscription or ESPN or whatever it may be.
Right.
So were there any big announcements at Streaming Media East that surprised people, or was it just kind of the mundane type stuff? Or
I wouldn't say there are any specific announcements. You have a lot of content owners there talking about things that they're doing in further details. For instance, Netflix was a keynote, and Netflix has never spoken before in public at a show about how they were building out their Open Connect content distribution network through last mile providers. So it wasn't an announcement on their part, but it was great that they spent, you know, 40 minutes with a slide deck showing here's what the hardware is, here's how you build it out, here's what you get from it, taking questions from the audience. So there's a lot like that at the show where content owners, we have ESPN as a keynote, we had CBS. They're talking about the success that they're having, what they're trying to do moving forward, what the business models look like. And that's really for us what the goal of the show is about. And a lot of shows out there, you're right, they focus on let's get a couple, you know, major announcements out or a new product launch at the show. You know, we're certainly not a CES.
Right.
You know, our show's been around for, I think, about 15 years now. And we do 3,000 to 4,000 attendees over 2 days. So it's a good size, but we're really focused on what I always tell people when I program the show as the chairman. We focus on giving people real world information and teaching them things that they can go and apply in their business right away. You know, the next day they can go encode content better because they learned how to do it in a hands-on tutorial class, or they understand a business model better or a technology aspect. So that's really what we focus on, is trying to inform, educate, and empower that attendee.
I've always wanted to go to your guys' show, but it seems like every time I get ready to register, I always end up with a conflict. But, you know, I definitely, you guys are always, it seemed to be, it's just, I don't know what it is, last couple of years it's been that way. But do you guys, from your guys' show, then some shows put together a package that you have to pay for to get the content later? Do you guys put that
all
up
free? All free.
Wow.
If you go to streamingmedia.com/videos, we make every session from every one of our shows in New York, California, and London every year 100% free with no ads in it. We don't monetize our video on purpose. We use it as a promotional vehicle for our shows, as a marketing source. So it typically takes a couple of weeks to get all the videos up. You know, it's about 100 hours of content per show.
That's
so we don't have the ones up yet from last week, but another 2 or 3 weeks we will.
That's incredible that you guys give that away. And
right.
I applaud you guys.
It's the only right way to do it. Sometimes we get a sponsor who might say, hey, we'd love to sponsor this year's video, and we'll run a, you know, 5 or 6 second logo in front of the videos thanking them. But we don't do that often. But yeah, we see video, and especially at streamingmedia.com, an industry resource where all the information we're providing is free. We have no paywall. Our magazine's free if you're qualified. We feel that showcasing the video content from our shows, it's what drives our business. Right. Every year, our attendees continue to go up and climb in terms of how many people come, because they can see the type of content they're missing when they go online. They can see that they're missing those interactions. And that's the real key for our show. It's not trying to take content and put it on the web and make it a pay-per-view event like some people do. No streaming technology will ever take place or take over what can be accomplished in person with a handshake.
That's true.
And that's something we've always been really adamant about in our shows.
Yeah. And it's that way with it. It's not the sessions. It's not the, well, it's at some point it is the exhibitors, but it's that conversation in the hallway that, you know, for me has always paid for a show, no matter the cost to go. So streaming media will be on the West Coast next year, correct?
Yes. And we're moving it next year. So the show originally started off, well, back in the days, it was in L.A. Back in the, actually, 99 was San Francisco. Then I think in 2000 moved to L.A. Once we started the show, once we took over the show and bought the business from Penton, we started doing it in Santa Clara. And then we moved it to San Jose. And then the last 2 years, we've done Los Angeles. But this year, we're actually moving it to Huntington Beach.
Oh, nice.
It's a much better venue. Easier to put on a conference because you, besides the exhibit space, you need a lot of conference rooms, you need a lot of hotel rooms, and it's very, actually very hard to do a show in LA because you'd be amazed. You think you're in downtown LA and, you know, these large hotels would have the resources you need, but, you know, we couldn't even get the bandwidth we needed at the last venue. We had to pull in extra bandwidth. So moving to Huntington Beach is going to make things a lot nicer for attendees.
And I don't even want to ask you what you paid for the bandwidth, because it's just incredible what those venues charge for that.
If I remember correctly, it was $25,000 for 3 days of bandwidth, and it wasn't even a lot. I think it was 40 megs.
And I paid $6,500 for 4 days at CES. It was crazy.
Right, it's ridiculous.
Rob, did you have any more questions for?
Yeah, Dan. So would you say that the streaming media show is moving more towards being a show for content providers as well as CDNs, or do you see it still primarily as a distribution topic show? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, so it's never been about distribution. The distribution is separate. So the day before Stream Media East, we have a separate show called Content Delivery Summit. You can see that at contentdeliverysummit.com. And there, this was the fifth year that we've done it. We spend the entire day just talking about the distribution of video, different technologies, OTT, last mile providers. You've got, you know, the Comcasts and the Verizons of the world talking about how they're building out for video. And we cover more than just video. We do DSA, transparent caching, FEO. So the Content Delivery Summit at the East Show is all about the infrastructure side. And then Tuesday and Wednesday, the Stream Media East Show and Stream Media West is always about content.
Okay.
Content technology, but it's about business models, monetization. We also do quite a bit on technical tutorials. So if you want to learn how to encode video for any iDevice, you can learn that in 1 hour. So we do still have a very large component of hardcore technology learning, which we'll always have. We do 4 workshops before the show starts, 4 3-hour workshops. So if you want something, if you want to learn in depth about encoding in more than just an hour, you can actually take workshops on it. So our show has always been for content owners and broadcasters, as shown by our 2 keynotes this year, ESPN and CBS. Previous years, we've had the guys from Microsoft. We've had Bill Gates. We've had everything from CE manufacturers to broadcasters to movie studios, and in some cases, syndicators and streaming services from guys like Netflix or an Amazon. So the show is always about what we always say is the business, technology, and content of online video. That's our three key focus.
Yeah, I was looking through your program, and I started to sweat a little bit because there's some very good stuff there. I can't wait to watch. You know, it's like you're like, ooh, you know, and it's like I couldn't go, but if I, you know, the second part.
Yeah, you know, I don't get to see any of the content at my own show because I'm so busy running around between four different tracks. So I'm just as excited as you are because I saw 0% of all the content produced at our show, and I have to wait till it comes online. So I'm in the same seat you are.
Yeah, I was like two or three in there. I was like, oh man, that's right there. When those are on, I'm watching those because you see the personalities and the topic, and you know either it's going to be a lively discussion or it's going to be a great tutorial. So do you think there's a future for guys like me and Rob that are doing these live shows? Do you think we'll ever get to the point where, you know, maybe we'll make the jump into broadcast television? You know, I laugh because not necessarily this show. I know we're seeing some jump over that way, but you know, I was at some event 2 or 3 years ago, and there was a whole bunch of cable guys up there, and they were talking, and me kind of a little bit naive, you know, walked up to the mic and said, "Hey, you know, I do a tech show, and I got a, you know, a very big audience online, and what is it going to take me to get into an hour slot in your cable box?" And the guy was pretty frank with me. He said, "You got it's going to take you 3 years and more money that you've got in your pocket." And I was like, yep. I was like, okay, that just basically pack sand and go away, young man. That's what it was.
Answer that. Yeah.
But do you see, is that merging, is it just the smart TV is ultimately going to be our only way in? Are we ever going to end up, I know certain content will end up in the broadcast head, but it's only going to be a small amount, won't it?
Yeah, the vast majority of it never will. And you shouldn't try and get into that business because the real value of your business is the fact you can reach a target audience online, which you can't do on broadcast TV.
Yeah.
And broadcast TV doesn't want you. The set-top box manufacturers don't want you. The streaming boxes don't want you. If you wanted to get your content on the Xbox 360 right now, could you?
No, Rob. No.
Because they wouldn't let you get on the box because they don't even have an open SDK.
Right.
So most of these boxes out there don't even have anything you can download and create a channel for, because they want their boxes to be thought of as premium content boxes.
Yeah.
They don't want anybody to be able to create content that they don't want in the box. So no, you're not going to get on that because they have all the control.
Yeah, they want channels. They don't want individual shows. And that's what we've done as a business, is made channels where there's, you know, if within the channel itself, there's, you know, there's lots of stuff. But, you know, there's, you know, on the Roku now, there's 400 channels. So even finding, you know, being found in the Roku itself is can be a challenge. So,
Todd, if it helps you, I guess, get more clarified on this, I think if you look at what happened to G4 and Tech TV, it gives you a pretty good example of what the chances are of making it on broadcast TV.
Well, I'm just saying that as an example. Obviously, I have no desire to put this show on broadcast TV. If it would, why do they want to watch this for an hour? But you know, I think, you know, long as the advertisers continue to spend money in the digital space, we're going to be okay. But ultimately, you know, my business is driven on advertising dollars and delivering services, and we need those dollars to continue to come in. And I can only imagine it's only going to go up. Yeah, I was thinking in 2004, my God, we need to hurry up. We are way behind the power curve. And here with 2013, I'm like, those expectations I had have not yet been met. It's sad. You know, it's like glaciers grow faster than this space does. I
it takes time.
The problem is that the glaciers are getting smaller, not getting bigger. No.
Yeah.
Hey, Dan, I think after all these years, you know, one of the big topics that we debated back in the earlier days of streaming was, was, you know, which was going to win, streaming or downloading? And I think if you look at podcasting today, it's still, you know, it's still a lot about download and things like that. But it's safe to say, and it's finally probably okay for us to just call the winner today is streaming.
But it's one in the same, Robert. It's one in the same. The consumer doesn't care.
Agreed. The consumer doesn't care. It's not relevant to the consumer. Yeah. It's like someone who asked me the other day, well, you know, a consumer is going to start demanding video be delivered via HTTP and push everyone away from RTSP and RTMP. No, because the consumer has no idea what protocols are.
Yeah, they don't care.
Now, consumers do understand the difference between a stream and a download. It's taken many years.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about here is the expectation. I know in the podcasting space, expectation is still both. And if you look at a lot of the, you know, Xbox and other places, you can choose between downloading or streaming. But the whole aspect of the download, obviously was because of the reliability of broadband for streaming. And that was one of the big issues of why streaming ever developed, right? Was back in the earlier days, it was, we didn't have a lot of bandwidth, so we had to trickle it out, right? So now we have tons of bandwidth, right? Well, why don't we just download it and it'll come down right away, and we have control of being able to play it back. But if you look at streaming today, streaming has kind of taken it to another level where it's like, well, let's stream at 2 megs per second or 4 megs per second. That's really what I'm talking about.
But Rob, you know, to me, streaming, again, going back to the consumer, the reason that we had to download the content before was strictly because there wasn't an iPhone in the early days of podcasting. They had to download it and sync it to the iPod. But now that we have connectivity, people just hit play. Unless they're getting on an airplane, that's the only time they probably pull data down. But the streaming standard from a, you know, the speed, it's all, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to put this thing up today in 3 different formats. Like, you know, the person picks their poison and they watch it. They don't care. They click play and they want it to play. It's, even though it's being downloaded, it's being streamed. So it's, to me, as long as the content's available on all glass and the consumer can get it wherever they want, when they want it, that's all I really care about, right?
So basically, streaming, kind of the principle behind streaming won in the end, and it did back in the early days of the web and the internet as well. I mean, that's, but we did go through this trough for a few years where it was more popular to download for some reason, and then over the last 5 years or so, the whole streaming part is charged back again. So, I mean, I'm just looking at it from the bigger picture, the long term. And Dan, I know that you know what I'm saying. It's this perception thing more than reality.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it just comes down to, you know, things change. I mean, you know, Roku, Apple TV, WDTV Live, none of these boxes even have storage in them besides some flash storage. So even if you wanted to download, you couldn't. It comes down to user preferences. Do you want to stream an Apple movie trailer, or do you want to download a higher res copy? You know, sometimes I'll download Apple movie trailers, better quality. Streaming definitely came about because of bandwidth issues.
Right.
But today you also have, you know, you can buy a digital download from Amazon and own a movie.
Yeah.
And you certainly have the ultraviolet stuff in the studio. So the good news is people aren't talking about streaming or downloading anymore. Which isn't what we want them talking about. We want them talking about the business model as opposed to the technology in the back end that the consumer never really sees.
And meanwhile, the consumers have a huge number of choices.
Oh, what you're showing right here. So this is a chart we released at the show called streammediadevices.com.
Yeah.
And this is an updated chart that shows all the different boxes in the market, there's 14 of them, what their technical specs are, and then which content platforms they support.
And it'd be interesting, though, if you guys followed that up with if we followed that chart up with ease of getting into the actual box. In other words, how easy is it for a content, some content entity to get into those devices. And, you know, I know reading right across the thing, I can say easy, 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 impossible, impossible, easy, easy, impossible. So, you know.
I think one of the choices we have on there is whether or not it has an open SDK.
Oh, that's.
I think we have that on there, but there's so many, you know, specs there. I can't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I'm going to print out here. I'm going to have to print that out on a big sheet, 11 by 17, so I can look at it. But very, very cool. Rob, anything else for Dan?
I don't think so. So what's the date of the Streaming Media West, Dan? Do you know offhand?
No, I don't. I'd actually have to look it up. It's November. I don't even recall. It's at the end of November. It's about a week before Thanksgiving. So it's November 18th, 19th, and 20th.
Well, I think I'm going to have to make sure I get those dates in a calendar. I want to come out, and we're working with live stream on some stuff, so maybe we'll come out on their dime if everything works out. But very, very cool. I hope you guys continue to grow as a show, and thanks for coming on and sharing. I it's interesting to hear your perspective on the space for sure.
Not a problem. I appreciate you guys having me. Certainly a good topic to talk about.
If they want to reach you, what's the best way for folks to Twitter account or something? What's the best way to reach you online?
Yeah, I mean, I'm as reachable as you can get. If you go to streamingmedia.com and you click on the Contact Us page, that phone number that's listed is actually my cell phone. So I answer my phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and have done so for more than 10 years. So if people ever have any questions about technology, market sizing, things of that nature, I'm probably the most easiest person to reach.
Don't abuse Dan, please.
Yes.
Dan does need to sleep now and then. So
every once in a while. Yes.
Keep that in mind.
Well, yeah, I'm on Twitter and all that other stuff as well. You can also go to danraber.com, but you don't have a problem finding my contact details.
Very cool. Dan, thanks.
So also, the whole streaming media show might be a really good alternative show for podcasters to attend too. Yeah. I know we're big into podcasting, Dan, as you might imagine, and podcasters need probably some education around more professional business models.
It would be good for podcasters who want to get into video. Our show does not cover podcasting as a topic. We don't cover anything audio only. We don't cover music. We don't cover radio streaming. There's plenty of good shows out there for that.
Yep.
So we're very focused on what we cover, but we do have quite a few podcasters coming who are looking to make the jump into video or want to learn more about the business model and targeting and things of that nature.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
So you would recommend it for video podcasters, it sounds like. Yeah.
Absolutely, because they'll learn about new products and services, how to do better in coding, monetization models, and then they can meet with vendors, you know, guys like Livestream and others are there. So anybody tied into video in any way, shape, or form, it's a good fit.
You know, one thing too is a selling point I always make for folks is that doing live forces you to be a better content creator. You have to have the prep done. If you don't have the prep done, it's going to be very obvious, very quick. But it makes, you know, that, and it really, I think for me at least, it took my show to the next level because I was forced. You know, I still make screw ups, but there's no editing live. You are right. It is what it is, and you can post edit that I don't do. But anyway, very, very cool. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
And good luck with your remodeling.
Thank you. I'm gonna go get some rest now.
All right.
See you later.
Take care.
Okay. Take care, Dan. Bye.
So interesting perspective, Rob, from Dan.
Yeah.
Not 100% what I was expecting, but interesting perspective.
Yeah, I think if you think about his kind of vantage point in the industry, he is a little bit more, I guess what you would say, more of a realist.
Yeah.
I mean he's certainly on the streaming side of the fence, which is really kind of an alternative thing to broadcast, but it sounds like he spends a lot of time with the broadcast folks, and I think he understands what's happening in the industry really, really well, and that we may not be facing as big of a revolution as I think a lot of people are wanting to see out there around television. And we may be stuck with what we have for longer than we realize would like.
Well, what it boils down to is we want those ad dollars to come out of TV into us. That's the sole reason. Let's not kid around.
Yeah.
You know, if the TV starts to decline, the media buyers will move to digital. They're going to move to digital.
Clearly. Well, I think that the real opportunity is around targeting. And I agree with Dan that it really hasn't been done to the degree that it needs to be. But that's the differentiator against broadcast is targeting.
Well,
and once that happens, I think that the game will start to change. And those CPM rates that we keep talking about that will make online distribution more viable will start to be possible.
In 2005, when we launched techpodcast.com, we knew that it was niche targeted content.
Yep.
You know, that's why we started this. And this is why this network still continues to have, the advertising dollars coming into it that it does. It's because it's targeted. Now it's tech. Have we been able to duplicate that success in travel and in other categories? Not to as great an extent, but the niche and the focus has always been, that's the top of the deck. That's the top of our media deck you reach who you want to reach, not the shotgun effect, with the number eight buckshot where it just goes everywhere. So,
yeah, I think that the number one network, and I'm talking about broadcast and online network, to keep an eye on is the Discovery Network.
Oh yeah.
I think those guys are already living in the future. And I think all of us can learn from what those guys are doing today. If you look at their broadcast properties are very, very reflective of the strategy that you just were talking about. The very niche content, right? They're very focused on going after small groups of groups that have a certain desire for a certain type of content, and they're extending that onto the cable side as well as the online side. You look at what's happening, and just this last week, the Discovery folks launched a new media property called Test Tube. And this area is another very, very niche content area, but I think it may be a glimpse of what they're working on in the bigger picture of a strategy around realizing that maybe the brand Revision 3 is not really a scalable brand, but maybe Test Tube might be. It's more. So I saw a big batch of new shows come out on testtube.com just this last week in the podcast area. And that's a completely new entry. And it's the first time that I've seen Discovery put out a new online channel. And that's, we shall see where this goes, but it's really a fascinating kind of move on their part. Who knows? This may be the network that kind of straddles the line between broadcast and online.
Well, one thing that we, from a business perspective, is I've been getting a lot of calls recently. Some of our stuff that we've been doing in the measurement space has gotten the attention of some folks, and the calls I'm getting are from niche verticals, but well-known niche verticals, people that, magazines that are, they're moving their magazine content to a digital format.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for them to measure how many magazines they've sold, but they're looking at us to do some of their media measurement. So we're seeing it, and I see mostly niche networks, but this Test Tube, it looks like they're just trying to find stuff that's going to rise to the top, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it may be a place for them to put their premium, their stuff that is actually really, really popular, and to build maybe a broadcast channel that lives with this as well. I think they've been playing around with the How Stuff Works stuff, and
yeah,
they've been trying to up that game a little bit more. They're taking a lot of the How Stuff Works properties and making shows through Revision 3. But they're definitely upping their game in the production quality and how they're sharing this across all of their distribution areas. The other one that's playing around with a lot of kind of more broadcast TV models, if you go look at some of the shows from CNET now, the Always On show is an interesting example. It's a show that's being put out as a video podcast, but it has what I would call kind of more traditional commercial breaks in it. So I haven't seen it show up on any kind of CBS network TV distribution, but I can clearly see where they're setting up this show that started out originally as a video podcast will, I think, ultimately wind up making a jump to some sort of broadcast model that they're working on. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like. But, clearly some of these online shows are going to move to broadcast. And I think it's just a matter of time before we start to see that happening.
I guess my ad blocker block them from running their video. Rob, we're already hour 40 so we'll wrap this up. Hey folks, if you want, contact us, Todd or Rob at the New Media Show, newmediashow.com, and send us your comments. The spammers found that account already. It's amazing how fast they did that.
Todd, you must have put it out there somewhere on the webpage or something. The
interweb someplace. But we're going to be on Sunday next week because I'm going to be flying back on Saturday. Who do we have next week?
I've got Amber Lawson.
Awesome.
And I made a mistake on the show last week. She's actually she's a chairman of, not the chairman, but a chairman of one of the subcommittees under the IAWTV organization. I think I mentioned IAWB or something like that. Right. Was what I mentioned last week. It's IAWTV.org is the actual organization. And they put on, some TV awards as well. Okay. It's the name of it is the International Academy of Web Television.
Oh, okay. So it'd be fun to have her on and talk about that space.
And she's also a former VP of video programming at America Online.
Oh, okay. So it'd be some good perspective there.
Yeah. There's more from, a content provider perspective, I think, is what we're going to have with her around web television. So it should be interesting.
Okay. Very cool. Hey, guys, they're watching. Thanks for being here. And for everyone else, we'll see you next week. And make sure you subscribe to the show. Until then, everyone, take care. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.